item, and we can go on to the director's report. Director Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Commissioners, and those of you who have joined us for our meeting today. I have, as usual, a kind of a series of topics to cover, to update the Commission on. Certainly not intended to include all of the things that have been going on, but just some of the highlights and or topics that I've been requested by Commissioners to speak to. The first topic I'd like to report on is an update on derelict fishing gear and efforts to remove derelict fishing gear and some of the rulemaking that you should anticipate coming forward in response to legislation that was passed this past session. As most of you know, the derelict gear has been collecting in Puget Sound, especially in the areas in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, in the areas from Everett north to the Canadian border. And the Northwest Straits Marine Conservation Initiative has made considerable progress toward addressing this significant marine and freshwater conservation concern, both by removing derelict fishing gear and by researching the impacts of that gear. The Department of Fish and Wildlife has supported their work and collaborates with them on the management of the statewide reporting system and databases. Funding and labor dedicated to this effort have been substantial, with the initiative spending more than $10 million of federal, state, and private money since 2002. Earlier this year, Governor Gregoire signed into law Senate Bill 5661. Which modifies RCW 7712870 to make it mandatory to report lost nets to the department within 24 hours of such loss. The department implemented an emergency regulation effective August 1, 2012 that requires reporting of lost nets within 24 hours. And the types of nets that are included in the rule include gillnet, purse seine, trawl, lampera, and reef nets. And we created two methods of reporting lost gear. One is a toll-free direct derelict gear reporting hotline, and the second is an online reporting system managed by the initiative, the Northwest Straits Marine Conservation Initiative. The department is developing permanent rules for action by the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and you should anticipate those coming forward later this year. The department is also evaluating net marking rules to determine if additional requirements are needed. In addition to derelict fishing nets, derelict crab and shrimp pots are also known to pose a significant risk to the ecology of Puget Sound. On September 1 of 2011, the provisions of Senate Bill 5385 took effect, which allocate $1 of each Puget Sound crab endorsement to the removal and disposal of derelict shellfish fishing gear in Puget Sound. The new endorsement fee is expected to generate an estimated $150,000. Of course, that would depend on the number of crab endorsements sold. And that amount would be anticipated to be collected each year and would be used for the removal of derelict shellfish fishing gear and will substantially improve our ability to respond to the major environmental concern that the loss of this gear imposes. Education and outreach has been a major component of the department's effort to stem the proliferation of derelict fishing gear. Obviously, it's easier to prevent a loss than it is to go out and recover that gear once it is lost. Through collaborative partnerships with stakeholder groups, approximately 5,000 recreational crabbing brochures and over 10,000 complete educational packets aimed at informing the public of the new law and the importance of that law to reduce the incidence of lost shellfish pots have been distributed to recreational crabbers in 2012. Changing subjects to that of the West Coast Brownfish Trawl Catch Sharing Plan. At the September meeting of the Pacific Fishery Management Council, the Council voted to recommend to National Marine Fisheries Service that it stay with the existing qualifying years used for the initial determination and issuance of quota shares for Pacific Whiting. The Council's original decision and subsequent approval and implementation by National Marine Fisheries Service was challenged by four plaintiffs that included the Owako Fish Company and two Washington-based fishing vessel owners. The plaintiffs argued before the Federal District Court that the Council failed to follow the provisions of the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery and Conservation Management Act in making the allocation of initial quota shares, and they focused on the provisions of the Act that speak to needing to consider recency and dependency on the fishery. The court remanded the issue back to National Marine Fisheries Service and then subsequently to the Council for further consideration. So over the last 9 months, the Council's been engaged in that analysis and consideration of whether or not the base periods that were used to determine the initial allocation distribution met the provisions of the Act. Nearly 70% of the coastwide harvest is taken by Washington-based fishers, including the Macaw tribe, leaving this a very difficult decision for us in terms of our participation in the discussion at the council level. We have motherships based in Seattle. We have catcher boats that deliver to motherships based in Seattle. We have catcher processors based in Seattle. We have catcher boats delivering to shoreside processors based both in Puget Sound and along the coast. And, of course, we have shoreside processing plants, two of them, Ocean Gold and Owako Fish Company. We also have other shoreside interests based in Washington, Bornstein Seafoods, which has a processing plant both in Bellingham as well as Astoria. So after careful consideration of all the relevant factors, the Council voted unanimously to stay with the original decision. We afforded that to National Marine Fisheries Service. We're now awaiting for National Marine Fisheries Service's review and final decision as to whether they'll uphold and support the Council's recommendation or whether they'll impose some other kind of remedy in response to the court's direction. Moving now to the Elwha Hatchery and the Hatchery Genetic Management Plan, Congressman Norm Dix called a meeting earlier this week that included myself and other, and Jim Scott and Pat Patillo from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, National Marine Fisheries Service, including Will Stell and Bob Turner, representatives of the Lower Elwha Tribe, and several members of the Hatchery Scientific Review Group to discuss marking issues associated with the Department of Fish and Wildlife's draft hatchery genetic management plan that was submitted for our Chinook hatchery production on the Elwha River. The primary issue was associated with when the fish would all be marked with an adipose fin clip and the threshold in terms of the number of natural origin fish that would trigger that action to mark all of those fish. We had a good discussion and left with a modeling assignment that specifically focused on what the appropriate trigger is. Right now, the trigger is 5,000 natural origin fish. I think most of the Hatchery Scientific Review Group members and some others around the table felt that that number is too high, and that the modeling used to determine that number wasn't necessarily complete or didn't include all of the factors that needed to be considered. So that was the primary assignment that came out of that meeting, was that trigger point. That trigger point will be important when we think about at what date, whether it's 2016 or 2018, that all of the production from that facility would have an adipose fin clip. Moving now to legislative meetings, Ann Larson, our legislative liaison, spent all last week crisscrossing Eastern Washington, visiting with legislators and discussing our legislative request proposals. I know she'll be going back and meeting with other Eastern Washington legislators, I believe, next week. I joined her in a meeting with Senator Hewitt in Prosser, and Jennifer Kwan and I joined Ann in a meeting with Senator Schessler in Asotin that also included a tour of the Cook property acquisition, which was in May 2012. We also had the opportunity to go up and visit the Smoothing Iron Ridge property that are both part of the Assotin Wildlife Area. I think we had some very good discussions, both in terms of issues surrounding land acquisition with Senator Schessler, as well as our legislative package and some of the budget challenges, particularly as it relates to fire, that we're going to be facing. Which leads me to fires. And I know Commissioner Schmitten spoke to this, as well as Commissioner Jennings and Duvia, and the conversations that were held at the Wildlife Committee meeting last night, and I'm certainly not going to try to cover all those, but I wanted to give you a little bit of some of the information that was shared last night. We all know that this year has been one of the most severe wildfire seasons in Washington's history. Nearly two dozen wildfires have cumulatively burnt over 15,000 acres. Known fire-related costs just since April of 2012 is in the $4 to $5 million range. And as the smoke clears, so do the estimates of the fiscal impacts. Costs for suppression, fire suppression from DNR and the fire districts is estimated at well over $1 million. Infrastructure damage, things like 30 miles of fencing, combination of both elk and boundary fence, the repair of that estimated at $2.6 million. Erosion control, habitat restoration, just beginning to understand what that is, but certainly in excess of $500,000. And compounding the problem, since we didn't receive general fund support for fire costs last year, we're carrying forward over $500,000 bill from the first fiscal year of this biennium. Wildlife staff are assessing impacts to winter range. So far, it appears areas in central Washington burn more summer range than winter range. We'll be posting information from across the state regarding those impacts on our website. Numerous groups have offered to volunteer to assist with winter feeding and other activities. Certainly appreciate everyone's willingness to help us. We're going to need it. While we are making those preparations, it's too early to predict exact measures that will be needed to be taken. There is still some opportunity for fall green-up, providing we get some rain. And we won't know the severity of the winter, obviously, for a few months. But we are preparing for the worst-case scenarios. We are tracking impacts to hunters and hunting seasons, as Commissioner Duvia spoke to. Wildlife Program is maintaining a list of hunters that may have been impacted, whether either a GMU was closed or access limited for the majority of the season. Our primary goal is to proceed with accommodating hunters within this year's hunting season. For instance, a special permit hunts with extended seasons. We are calling and notifying hunters when areas reopen. Some hunters also were in the field prior to the extensive closures. Our second alternative is to move hunters to participate in a hunt later in the year. These will be worked out on a case-by-case basis and considering the local impacts of those additional hunts. Finally, some areas in hunts may require points to be restored if the GMU or the hunt was not open for the year. Like everyone, we're watching the weather closely, and hopefully the general muzzleloader seasons that's just beginning will not be impacted. But as everyone else, we're keeping our fingers crossed for some rain. We are developing outreach materials and additional information that will be available to hunters early this next week. We've stayed in close touch with the governor's office and Department of Natural Resources in considering what other measures we might take, including the types of emergency regulations that we enacted several weeks ago for prohibiting certain types of activities on our lands, to try to do everything we can to minimize the potential for additional fires on department lands. Lastly, just wanted to report on a partnership that was developed with Cabela's. Effort was led by our Public Affairs and Community Relations Director, Bruce Bodka. Carrie McLaren from the Region 3 Enforcement Program recorded the first set of radio ads this week in our partnership with Cabela's. We're collaborating on a series of ads that will run in the Yakima radio market in conjunction with the opening of the Cabela's store near Union Gap. Cabela's is paying for one-minute spots and dividing the time with us. Carrie reported the recording sessions that she's had thus far went well, and the Region 3 managers and field staff have provided a lot of good information that she was able to utilize as well. Each of our 30-second spots will run for a week between 7 and 8 a.m. on three different stations in the area. I can give you those if you need them. The first ads are about elk and bird hunting and High Lakes fishing opportunities, and as well as hunter safety. Our spots will run through Thanksgiving and will resume again next spring. So we'll also be able to promote kids fishing and a wide range of other activities with this really great partnership. This is just one example of several partnerships that Bruce has been able to pull together. I know the
Commissioner Perry has a question.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me, Director, but I wondered if those ads, particularly in the Yakima Valley, were strictly English, or were they? Was there some Spanish language? Because I think there's a lot of hunters and people who enjoy wildlife and so forth that probably are not English speakers in that area.
Bodkin's in the audience. And,
it's just English so far that I'm aware of, but thanks for pointing that out.
Thank you.
That concludes my director's report. Of course, we do. There's been an awful lot of activity relative to wolf management and specifically to the wedge pack, and I'll be participating in the update that we give you this afternoon, but I didn't want to do that now and break when we had a lot of our stakeholders and interested citizens were yet to be here. So I'll be participating in that briefing here after lunch.
Okay. Commissioner Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bruce, I think that's a really good partnership with Cabela's. And I just, could that be rolled out in with other regions and other Cabela's around the state?
Because Bruce, could you come up to the front desk? We want to talk with you. This is what I was going to try to get done, is bring Bruce up here. We want to start talking with Bruce because he's our new, what's your official title?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bruce Botka. I'm the commission, the department's public affairs and community outreach manager.
Okay, outreach manager.
Thanks for the opportunity to address you this morning. A couple things on Cabela's. First of all, we've really been talking with them periodically about this becoming a larger and more ongoing partnership. In fact, their regional marketing manager is going to try to be in Olympia this afternoon, and we were going to have a quick conversation, and that's certainly something I'm trying to promote. And so far, they've been very receptive. As for the question about the language of the ads, we've been basically kind of playing off their marketing plan for promoting the new store. I actually don't know if they're doing Spanish language advertising. The three stations that the ads will be running on are sort of the main market Yakima radio area that all broadcast in English. But I think it's a great idea to try to do multi-language promotions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up, Bruce, does Cabela's do this in other states, do you know? And if they do, is there a model that we could look at to even improve upon? And if they don't, could we set the bar as the model?
When we started talking with them, they shared with us some advertising that they had done in the state of Colorado with the Fish and Wildlife Department there. So this is a model they've used before, I think in a fairly limited way. One of the questions I have for them is potentially where could this go? What kinds of options do they see, and are, you know, they're paying the freight for this program. So we're basically trying to leverage what I can tell you is a fairly small outreach budget on in my department right now. But this is a pretty good opportunity for us to get started and to see what might be possible out there. And the other thing is that this makes a great platform for us to reach out over a period of time to other companies and you know, make similar kinds of agreements and arrangements.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Jennings.
Just wanted to compliment you on getting the momentum started so quickly, and now that the momentum started, we're all expecting that snowball to get bigger and bigger. So
the season change is good for snowballs with any luck if we get some precipitation. Thank you very much, Commissioner Jennings. I have to tell you, it doesn't feel very quick to me. I remember sitting before you in June talking about what have proven to be incredibly optimistic timelines. A few issues have arisen since then that kind of have us a little bit preoccupied.
Yes.
But I'll probably be ducking out of the meeting this morning and to go try and carve out a little more planning time.
And you will be joining us this evening for the big tent?
I would not miss the big tent meeting and dinner. I'm looking forward to that.
Okay, good. Because we're going to discuss your strategic plan or your work plan that you've devised at that point.
I have other couple
that.
Issues that will be.
So we're looking forward to working.
I am too. Thanks.
Commissioner Perry?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to ask with... so many headlines and reporting and so on in terms of the wolf issue. I think the department has performed very well and used scientific information and consulted experts in other states and so forth to try to come to a conclusion. And I wondered if this information is getting out. Sometimes some of the articles that I've read seem to be not very well informed, and I wondered if this was a priority in your office.
This is a priority from the director's office on down, and certainly it's been our highest priority recently. Excuse me. One of the observations that I'd have after a few months in this department is that our information is getting out probably as effectively as I've ever seen in an agency setting in state government. One of the things that we've talked a little bit about has been the use of social media as well as other forms of technology-based communication. We've been issuing news releases, statements, frequently asked question documents to our media distribution lists, to interested parties who've signed up for feeds of information. We've posted everything on our website, on the agency Facebook page, and we can tell from the phone calls, the emails, the interaction on Facebook, that we're getting really what seems to me to be pretty thorough penetration. We've been getting phone calls, contacts from as far away as South Africa, Belgium, around the world, really. So it's and then another thing that happens that I wasn't fully aware of when I started is the sort of the add-on effect of, for instance, a newspaper or an organizational blog linking to our work and then promoting it through their own networks. And it just kind of multiplies exponentially in that way. So I've been pretty confident that our information is getting out. The second part of your question about the nature of the coverage, I think the nature of the media and information blogosphere is such that there's a huge range of expertise out there right now, that the media industry has changed dramatically over the last 10 to 20 years. We deal with people, in some cases, who are experts in covering these issues in environmental reporting, right down to an intern reporter whose editor might have said, call Fish and Wildlife and find out what's going on, and they call us. They haven't even looked at our website. So it's kind of a full meal program that we run every day in that office. I have to say it's totally exciting and very challenging, and I think that we're doing a pretty good job. And I don't want to you know, pat ourselves on the back too much, because there's constant opportunities for improvement.
Great.
Thank you.
Good spirit.
Thanks.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bruce, appreciate you coming up to the hot seat here. Early on, I think even before you hired, we had a dinner meeting with you, if I recall.
That's right.
And one of the areas of interest to many of us, if not all of us on the commission, was try to figure out a way to involve more youth in the outdoor type activities that we're responsible for. I just would maybe get a little progress report on your view of that, and have you had any dialogue with the people at Cabela's about the importance of youth involvement in the future of our outdoor activities?
Well, first, I guess I'd say that the progress doesn't feel all that quick to me, but it's something that I try to push on pretty regularly. We have spoken with Cabela's about that exact issue. They've also worked with the department in the past in kind of a little smaller project basis, at least smaller than what I hope this becomes. And they're very interested in that kind of promotion as well. It definitely fits with their business model. As this particular program in Central Washington plays out, what they plan to do is to run about the first five or six of our ads within, you know, the sort of the shared 30-second and 30-second promotion right up through mid to late November, when they shift over into their real concentrated holiday advertising. Then after a little bit of a break for the winter, come back in the spring in this same market, and I hope beyond just that, and specifically promoting kids fishing, outdoor opportunities for the family, that sort of thing, that kind of hook up and ramp up in the spring, and I certainly hope, you know, through the summer next year. And that's another one where what we learn and what we experience in this effort, you know, hope to take and apply in other areas too with that same theme.
Sure. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much for...
Thank you very much.
Coming up and talking with us. Okay, are there any other comments? If no one else wants to jump in, wanted to compliment you on the razor clam season decision. It's been extremely well received down in my neck of the woods. The announcement was that the agency was liberalizing in a wise conservationist mode, but liberalizing the exploitation rate. So, Director Anderson, you want to explain that? I don't know if you have any numbers about the percentage of increase that's going to result in, but...
Thanks, Madam Chair. Well, we've been looking at the issue of what the exploitation rate on razor clams is as it relates to the total population, and whether or not we're taking advantage of the harvest opportunities that are there, or whether or not we're harvesting at too high a rate. You may recall that prior to us in the 80s, the 70s, the 80s, there was very little stock assessment type work done. We did develop, Doug Simons developed a mark recapture method of trying to assess the population and survival rates of razor clams, where they mark the shell with a device. And then we moved to where we started to do transects, and we developed a pumping system where there's a large cylindrical piece of stainless steel that's and with heavy use of water, where they're able to put that cylindrical piece of stainless steel into the sand, and they emulsify the sand with water, and the razor clams that are present within that cylinder come to the surface, and you're able to count them. And so they've, over the years, and this was started by Doug Simons and was carried on with by Dan Ayers, where we're doing these systematic transects of each one of the beaches that allow us to ascertain the total population, the size and age, and come up with our harvestable amount. Up to this point in time, we've used a fixed rate of 30%. So we ascertain the through our, this transects and population survey, the total number of harvestable clams, those that are above a particular size, and I think the size is 3.5 inches, but don't hold me to that. And then we multiply that total number by 30%. That then gives us a quota for each one of the beaches, and then we set seasons accordingly. And we monitor the catch, and when we reach the quota, we close the season. There have been some significant interest in by some constituents about us taking a look at that harvest rate and whether or not could we go to 32, could we go to 40%, could we go to some higher exploitation rate that would provide some additional harvest opportunity and all of the associated economic benefits that are derived from having longer seasons in coastal communities. And so we did some extensive work on that over a two-year period, and with our biometricians developed an abundance-based exploitation rate approach such that when the populations are low, the harvest rate is lower, or the exploitation rate is lower. So in some cases, if we have low populations of abundance, we will be looking at harvest rates that are less than 30%. But when we have high abundance, then we would have higher harvest rates, as high as, I believe, 33% is as high as it goes. So it's a fairly small change, and I don't have all the numbers committed to memory. I haven't looked at it for a couple of months. But we have this graduated harvest rate approach to determining quotas based on the abundance through our surveys that we do for each beach. So the result is where we have good abundances like we do this year, that we'll be able to add somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 4 days on the beaches where we're using this over what it would have been if we'd had that fixed rate. Now, we're only applying this to the beaches at Twin Harbors and Long Beach. We haven't applied it to the North Beaches, and the reason for that is we haven't completed our discussions, and we don't have agreement with our co-managers, and in particular with at Mock Rocks, the Moclips Copalis Rock Beach, and then the beach at Ocean Shores. I'm sure they're going to figure out that door's locked. So that's the Quinault Indian Nation, and they're reviewing the work that we did, and they've assured us they're going to try to do that review in a very timely way, so that there's a potential that we could apply this change in harvest rate approach to the beaches at Copalis and Mock Rocks before the season's out. So I've talked with their policy representative, Ed Johnstone, and I believe that they will complete their review, and we will have discussions with Quinault Indian Nation by the end of this year, by December. So in the event, and that additional harvest rate is not going to impact our seasons up and through December, so that would only be, the impact would be at the tail end of the season, so in the March-April timeframe. So we're pretty excited about this. We think it makes better sense from a biological perspective, having this abundance-based exploitation rate determination. And I'm hopeful that Quinault Nation will look at our work and agree with us that it's a superior way to the fixed harvest rate that we've used in the past.
Well, it truly is much appreciated. In Pacific County, those few days bring lots and lots of people out to the county when the weather's not always very good, but they come out and they brave the winds and the rain and And I've been out there too myself, so I'm looking forward to this season. I hope some other commissioners think about coming down and clam digging. Lots of fun.
I think our first opportunity is going to be a week from this weekend, I believe.
Yeah. Mid-October, some good tides. Okay, any other general comments? All right, then we can move on.